National Gallery Podcast.
This is the National Gallery Podcast, and I'm Miranda Hinckley. We start this month with Seduced by Art, Photography Past and Present, the gallery's first exhibition devoted to photography. The show traces the close relationship between photography and fine art by putting the two side by side. One pairing that's attracted attention is the placing of Thomas Gainsborough's portrait of Mr. and Mrs. Andrews from about 1750 next to a 1991 photograph of an up-and-coming professional couple, taken by that keen observer of modern British life, Martin Parr, a portrait which was taken to accompany a BBC television series called Signs of the Times. The couple in question, Richard and Abigail Brommel, met up with Leah Caribbean to explain how it feels to see their younger selves hung on a wall in the National Gallery. But first, the show's curator, Hope Kingsley, explained why she decided to place Martin Parr's photograph alongside Thomas Gainsborough's painting.
Well, certainly one of the key points in this part of the exhibition and the project is that whether painted or photographed, portraits share stylistic devices and conventions, and they share narratives, including social context. We are very aware of the humanity in Gainsborough's work, a young couple at the beginning of their lives, with their world, as it is a shared world, opening up beyond them. I felt very strongly that Martin Parr's picture gave the same sense of the sitters and the same sense of their world as a young couple.
That's wonderful, and that brings me on to the Brommels, who we actually have the two sitters for this portrait here with us, Richard and Abigail. And I was wondering, Richard, if I could start. I mean, talking about that idea of a young couple starting out, could you just explain where you and Abigail were at this moment? What time is this for you in your lives?
Well, we were just married and in 1991, and it was that was our first house with our first few little possessions, some of which were begged, borrowed or stolen.
Basically, when you look at that photo, you are looking at our house. That is almost all of it that there was. It was very small.
And I understand, Abigail, that Martin Parr has a sort of technique of making people wait. There's a sort of gap between the actual taking up of a pose and the taking of the photograph. Did that actually happen for you?
It did seem to take an awfully long time. And, you know, none of that is accidental. He wanted us in exactly those positions. I seem to remember he told us about four or five times that we weren't allowed to smile, no, even, which is actually quite unnerving when you're sitting there with someone you don't know and you're, you know, the natural reaction, I think, is to smile
yeah,
and appear friendly, isn't it?
Yeah.
There is nothing about what he did that was trying to put us at our ease. He was in charge and wanted us to feel very aware of the situation, I think, somehow.
It's okay for Abigail, she was sat down, but I was standing bolt upright. You know, sort of hear my father sort of, you know, telling me, you know, so stand up straight, you know, shoulders back. And that's really what I'm kind of doing there, really.
But I do think that actually the tension comes out because you in particular, Abigail, have this rather wonderful look that's sort of both a bit suspicious, a bit wary and almost saucy and in fact a bit challenging to him. It's not a million miles away, I feel, from the look that Mrs. Andrews has in the Gainsborough portrait. Something that's slightly, yes,
painful almost, sort of.
I quite like it. I quite like it. I don't like myself, but I think generally when you see yourself in a picture, in a photograph, it's always yourself that you don't actually like. You tend to like everyone else, and everyone else tends to look very at ease.
Do you agree?
Thank you. Yeah.
And in terms of the fact that it was seen at the time and people did see it, how did you feel? Did you feel as if you'd been slightly exposed by this photograph?
I tend to look back at it more fondly today than I think I possibly did at the time. Like so many things, it seemed like a great idea at the time, and then it comes out and you're thinking, well, are we really like that? We don't see ourselves as like that. Do our friends see us as like that? The answer is usually no, but that is what we are clearly in the eyes of other people.
But also that's art. That's not just us. That is his interpretation of us, isn't it? So we didn't spend many evenings standing in the lounge looking like that, but that's how he saw us, so...
Can I just finally ask, I mean, how do you feel about it now? Here you are at the National Gallery.
I think it's amazing. Bizarre, really. I mean, you know, have you ever had your picture hung in the National Gallery? It's not something I ever thought that would happen. It's really bizarre.
What I think is also strange is one of the people who works for us is a Martin Parr mad fan and has got all his books and has actually looked at us previously and hadn't connected us as being his bosses, which is quite amazing as well.
But I suppose when you age, what you were part of when you were younger becomes more interesting to people, doesn't it? It's social history. So I suppose now that we're a tiny bit older, we can see it a little bit more like that, especially as we've moved on. We've now got two downstairs rooms.
Thanks to Abigail and Richard Brommel and Hope Kingsley. If you'd like to see Seduced by Art, photography past and present, you've only got a few more weeks. It closes on the 20th of January. Tickets are available from the gallery or online with a booking fee at www.nationalgallery.org.uk. Next, to a painting by the 16th century Italian artist Niccolò dell'Abate. It depicts a scene from Greek mythology, as told by the ancient Roman poet Virgil, in which the nymph Eurydice flees from a shepherd who's taken a fancy to her, Aristaeus. Their dramatic encounter is set in a highly atmospheric, lush green landscape, as art historian Jo Reimer explained when she took Cathy Fitzgerald to see Niccolò's The Death of Eurydice.
It's almost like a stage set, really. It's like being at the theatre. You could imagine perhaps the sound of thunder, the sound of lightning. You've got a real sense of sort of a storm brewing. And then over to the right-hand side, you've got this sort of very peculiar, I suppose, city, sort of urban scape, which comprises a range of most peculiar buildings. You've got castles there that look as though they come from Northern Europe. You've got temples. You've got some buildings that seem to be in quite good repair. Others seem to have fallen down. They're like ruins. And they are all of the same sort of colour, a very sort of ghostly, grey, sort of spectral kind of colour. And it makes you feel almost as though you've ended up in a sort of magical landscape, actually. It's a perfect setting, perhaps, for the story.
And the story runs across the front of the painting, doesn't it? It's almost like a cartoon strip. We see the same characters, but time's moved on between scenes.
Yes, and I think this is really important, that when you look at a landscape painting, you usually assume it's all one time. But this picture is actually encapsulating lots of moments, and they're all sectioned off. So right in the centre, we have Eurydice, our heroine, who's running towards the right-hand side of the picture, but's looking over her shoulder behind her. She's got this man running after her. His arms are widely stretched. It's all incredibly dramatic. And because she's not looking where she's going, you almost feel, she's had this dreadful accident. She steps on a snake. She gets bitten and she dies.
Yes, so we see her twice, don't we? Yes. So we see her in the middle of this very dramatic scene, obviously very frightened of this man who's pursuing her.
Yes.
And then on the floor again, we suddenly see her and she's lying flat out, and you can see the tiny snake, can't you?
Yes, I mean, it is tiny, and I think the reason it's small is probably because people would have known this story and wouldn't need a great big snake to illustrate it, whereas today perhaps we have to look a bit more carefully. I mean, Aristaeus really seems to be sort of love-struck in a way, probably doesn't seem to get the hint that actually Eurydice loves somebody else. I don't think he wishes her any harm. I don't think he intended to hurt her, but in running after her, in his desire to catch up with her, as it were, this terrible accident sort of occurs.
So what happens next?
The next stage is that Aristaeus has a mishap as well. He keeps cattle and he keeps bees. Because he's caused indirectly the death of Eurydice, he's cursed and all of his bees die and he's terribly upset. And in the painting you can see him over in the distance on the right-hand side talking to the woman who is probably Cyrene, his mother. She sends him to Proteus, the river god, in the corner with his urn, and he says that you're going to have to sacrifice something, Aristaeus, and you may or may not get your bees back. And so the bulls and his cows, some of them are sacrificed, his bees return. So Aristaeus really in some ways perhaps is sorted out, but there's still a problem, because in this story, of course, Eurydice didn't love Aristaeus, she loved Orpheus, and Orpheus loved her, and Orpheus wants his Eurydice back.
Who was Orpheus?
I think one of the things that's really just incredible about this painting is that Niccolò is able to give us a sense of the next stage of the story without actually showing it. Orpheus is probably most well known for his beautiful music, and we're told that his music was so exquisite it charmed not just the animals but also the plants. And you can see in the painting that he's surrounded by a very strange, incongruous group of animals, including a unicorn, a tiger, and what looks like a rabbit. And this is really how he charms his way into the underworld. He charms the gods. He persuades them to allow him to have his Eurydice back. And he's told that that will be fine. She will follow you out of the underworld, but on no account must you turn back to check that she's there. And sadly, everything is going terribly well, and it's just as they're about to surface, as it were, that he breaks the rules, as sometimes we do, that's human nature. He looks round, she was there, and now she's disappeared, and she's gone forever. It's a very sad story, but there's something really quite exquisite in that sadness. It's incredibly beautiful.
Joe Reimer. If you'd like to see Niccolò dell'Abate's painting for yourself, you'll find The Death of Eurydice on display in Room 2. And now to one of the National Gallery's best-loved depictions of a child, the portrait of the six-year-old Johann Friedrich of Saxony. Painted by Lucas Cranach the Elder in 1509, the little boy occupies one side of a diptych, or two-panelled picture, opposite his widowed father, Johann the Steadfast. While the father's clothes are dark and sombre, Johann Friedrich's outfit is colourful and flamboyant. It also emulates the dress of some of the most feared men in early 16th century Europe. Leah Caribbean visited the picture with costume historian Margaret Scott and began by asking her to describe little Johann Friedrich's distinctive attire.
He is wearing a green hat with curled ostrich feathers along the top, and the brim has been flipped over to allow him to incorporate a number of pieces of gold jewellery. His hair is fashionably long and curly. That was a very admired feature of young German males' appearances in the late 15th and early 16th centuries. And foreigners often went wow when they saw it. They couldn't believe this. They would actually go up and touch it. And his main garment is green over red. The green is slashed to show the red underneath, and on top of these sleeves and on the bodice of the garment there are strips of different coloured ribbons which are overlaid on the bodice in a kind of grid pattern. If you look very closely, you'll actually see that they don't match up in the way they're spaced down the arms, which would suggest to me that the painting was actually done rather in a hurry and possibly doesn't even reflect what the boy would have worn. It may be a fiction for the sake of the painting.
Now, if it's a fiction for the sake of the painting, this outfit is very particular, isn't it? It actually does relate to a type of outfit. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Well, slashing was quite popular in men's dress in the early 16th century. It was particularly popular in German men's dress, and even to some extent extended to German women's dress. And if you look at other Cranachs in the National Gallery, for instance, a slightly later one of a young lady in a red velvet dress, you'll see she has extraordinarily slashed, bunched sleeves. Now, this kind of clothing was particularly associated with the most feared mercenary soldiers in Europe at the time, who were known as Landsknechte. And they had clothing whose hallmark was the most elaborate slashing imaginable. Cutting and slashing to the point where you think the clothing was in danger of falling apart. The Landsknechte had also very, very large hats with ostrich feather plumes in many cases. You would think totally impractical for going into war. And they also loved gold jewellery. Now, the little boy is wearing, as you see, a chain that is made out of flattened gold links.
That seems extraordinary to me, that you would dress a child as a mercenary soldier. I mean, the Landsknechte are really feared, aren't they?
Oh yes, they are definitely feared. You did not want to come up against a troop of Landsknechte because you were likely to lose, until firearms became much more effective later in the 16th century. But they actually became fashionable as people to imply you had in your employ. Henry VIII had his bodyguards dressed in bits of Germanic clothing in the 1510s. But I think also what's quite interesting is that I think that a lot of men probably took it on because they wanted the macho-ness that went with it.
So the fact that he's dressed in this very flamboyant way that directly references these Landsknechte actually is quite symbolic, is quite meaningful.
I think it is potentially quite meaningful. It would have been understood as being fashionable, but in the context of a child, it does seem extraordinary, certainly to our eyes, because we tend to look on children who are dressed as adults with a great deal of suspicion, like three-year-old beauty pageant queens. It's a bit questionable. But I think that we have to understand the context. He is also the only child heir to the electors of Saxony. Now, if we go back to the colours of the clothing, green was very commonly regarded as symbolic of hope. Recently, we've had politicians going on about the green shoots of economic recovery. Well, they've quietened down a bit about that recently. But that's a very long-standing symbolic association of green. So he is possibly here the hope of the country. Red underneath. Red had a very clear symbolic meaning to do with blood, which then went on to do with the red planet Mars, the god of war. And one of the other symbolic meanings of red was a willingness to fight for one's country. And then this type of clothing associated with the Landsknechte, the mercenary soldiers, also brings in another message, because Landsknecht means literally servant of the country. So Johann Friedrich could well have been seen at the time in this image as the hope of his country, who is prepared to fight for his country, be an eventual ruler, but at the same time be the servant of the country in its defence.
Margaret Scott, talking about Cranach's two electors of Saxony, on display in Room 4. That's it for this anniversary episode, our 75th since we launched back in 2006. You can find an extensive archive featuring our past shows online at www.nationalgallery.org.uk/podcasts. And if you're visiting this month, don't forget we're open 10 till 6 daily and till 9 on Fridays. Until next time, goodbye.